on the back.
Yes.
Thing. So if you need the website, it's easy anyway. It's amymiller.com, but you can catch it back there. So that's easy. Thank you very much, whomever did that.
Amy. We are sold out, but we started a waiting list.
Woohoo! It's a good book. I think you'd like it. I think it's very clear. So, insight into emptiness. Many emptiness books, okay? Jose Cabazon, I think he's at Santa Barbara, UC Santa Barbara, A Dose of Emptiness. If you want Tenets, the Four Philosophical Schools with a Context of Emptiness, that's one sort of view, you know, one type of like that you could go into. Jeffrey Hopkins, obviously. Before you get to Meditation on Emptiness, his PhD thesis, Emptiness Yoga. Very helpful, easier, Emptiness Yoga. But don't jump into these books. These are really heady, pithy books. But it's very nice. It's got exercises. Each chapter is another little exercise, okay? If you suffer from depression, Emptiness Yoga. You won't stay depressed. You know, what I mean is you open up to a chapter and you really go through the chapter till you understand. It's very technical. It's quite profound. Go through the chapter slowly, really, and do some of the exercises he said. It's hard to stay sitting in your mind of depression. Like, it's a great antidote for stuff like that. So just a suggestion. Meditation on Emptiness, the beginning part takes you through the whole, you know, philosophy of like how to get ready, like I was just talking about the three principles of the path, three higher trainings, the context of it all. Okay, but you have to slowly start again with the smaller books I mentioned last night. Start with the emptiness sections of The Essential Nectar, also known as The Essence of Nectar, a basic Lam Rim book, small, and or The Essence of Refined Gold. Very palatable Lam Rim books. Make sure you understand the emptiness section there. Then maybe pick up Liberation in the Palm of Your Hand. Go to the emptiness section there. Bigger outlay of it. Okay? You could look at Echoes of Voidness at the same time. That would relay. Okay? Then maybe you want to look at the Lam Rim Chenmo. That's the great treatise of the Lam Rim. So that's going to be really detailed. Okay? We're all waiting for Geshe Sopa's commentary, which is Volume 5. Of the commentaries to the Lam Rim Chenmo. Four of them are out. Some of you familiar with big maroon books. Fantastic. Fantastic. Unbelievable. So I found these really helpful, even if you're not looking at the Lam Rim Chenmo, to read the commentaries, because he taught for 40 years in the West as a professor, University of Wisconsin, Geshe Zopa, passed away last summer. Or a couple summers ago, I can't remember. And then he wrote these commentaries in a number of teachings he did through the summers and through the years. And so the first one is about preliminaries. I think the second one is on karma. Third one is maybe on bodhicitta. And the fourth one just came out is on shine. So the fifth one is on emptiness. So hope I live that long to get that commentary. So this is the way you get, you know, you keep adding to your wisdom with going to a little bit deeper explanation. And then sometimes I go back and pick up an earlier book to refresh, to always get another perspective. Make sense? Like that? So now we're going to do some concentration meditation. I'm joking. The reason is, okay, be wise with yourself. You just ate. It's very difficult to sit and do any kind of concentration after you eat. You're like leaden. You're like, especially if you overeat. It's like, okay? So this is the time in the class where everybody gets sleepy, and I look out and everybody's like, okay? So I'm going to wake you up, okay? I'm going to try. So once again, let's just check our motivation. Why am I here? Because I'd like to get some more understanding of emptiness. Why do I want to do that? To counter negative experiences in my mind. Why do I want to do that? So I can finish my suffering. So I can move along a path to become a Buddha. Because that's a means, that's not the end goal, that's a means to benefit all other beings perfectly. I'd really like to help all beings. Myself is included. Okay, that's okay. And so that's the reason we're going to get together right now. It's for that purpose. And then a little motivation. Thank you so much to Donna and all the people that set up some of the things I had asked. And I forget, is this the right coffee? There's a prayer I love, Lamrim Prayer by Lama Tsongkhapa, called Lines of Experience. Some people familiar? Lines of Experience. And I used to read this the first time I went to Laodo. Laodo, in the old days it was really primitive, and it's still primitive, but now they have electricity, and they have a couple porcelain toilets in the ground. That's fancy for Laodo. So the first time I went, it was really hard. I'd never been alone like that doing some retreat. So I read this every night to inspire myself, this Lamrim prayer. And I just want to read, it's just beautiful. Lama Tsongkhapa writing how he practices. Okay? And at the end of some of the verses, and the translation I really like, he says at the end of them, I, a yogi, practice like this. You, O liberation seeker, should do likewise. Okay. Are you a liberation seeker? Right? It's something to think about, right? It's right. Like this is, he's like, here's what you do. Okay? So regarding emptiness, he says, discriminating awareness is the eye to behold the profound emptiness. It is the path to uproot ignorance, the source of cyclic existence. It is the treasure of genius, praised in all the scriptural pronouncements. It is renowned as the supreme lamp that illuminates the darkness of closed-mindedness. Knowing this, the wise that wish for liberation advance themselves along this path with every effort. I, a yogi, practice this way. You, O liberation seeker, should do likewise. Okay? So just for a moment, I'm going to read it again. Close your eyes. Just reflect on this paragraph. Discriminating awareness is the eye to behold the profound emptiness. It is the path to uproot ignorance, the source of cyclic existence. It is the treasure of genius praised in all the scriptural pronouncements. It is renowned as the supreme lamp that illuminates the darkness of closed-mindedness. Knowing this, the wise that wish for liberation advance themselves along this path with every effort. I, a yogi, practice this way. You, O liberation seeker, should do likewise. Just slowly reflect on that. And relax. It's just a beautiful prayer. I was thinking of this translation. What does it say? Because it goes through all the perfections. Profound wisdom is the eye with which to behold profound emptiness and the path by which to uproot fundamental ignorance, the source of cyclic existence. It's the treasure of genius praised in all the scriptural pronouncements and is renowned as a supreme lamp that eliminates the darkness of closed-mindedness. Knowing this, the wise who have wished for liberation have advanced themselves along this path with every effort. I, a yogi, have practiced just that. You who also seek liberation, please cultivate yourself in the same way. Beautiful. Thank you. (Clears throat) Okay, so what is ignorance? We want to understand, how do we get hooked? How do we get hooked in this? Ignorance. And the other thing is, looking at ourselves as practitioners. I also just wanted to ask a little bit from the lunch discussion. And I heard it wasn't all about, you know, your practice and your role, right? Our exercise was personal goals, where liberation and omniscience fit in your life, the practice, the value of the lineage and the teachers. What do you think about that? How was the lunch discussion? Any insights from that? Any comments? And I also want you to know that, you know, this device, this thing that's shaped like this, it's not inherently existent, okay? I saw some of you at lunch. It's like, gotta have my fix, right? Yeah. Some of you, looking at your ages, remember before these things? Somehow we survived, didn't we? Isn't it amazing? How is it possible? What's that?
I was 50 years without one.
And he's still here. He's still here to talk about it, right? So, again, notice what your mind's familiar with. What are your habits? What do you spend a lot of time doing in your break times and in your... Just notice, because there's ways to kind of... I have tech holidays, right? I don't turn on this computer. I don't turn my phone on. You'll survive. It's okay. Now, I know some of you have kids, and you say, is there a home phone where they can reach you, or do you let them know, you know, I'm not putting my phone on tomorrow if you need to reach me? Just be responsible. Let people know. See what happens. People end up, they spend more time in nature. They're reading more, interpersonal relationships. There was an exercise they did at I can't remember which college, university, sociology department did an exercise in a class for 1 or 2 weeks, the students. No technology. These are college students today. Can you imagine? No social media, no phone, no computer, no telephone they did a report at the end of how much more exercise they got, how much more sleep they got, how much more better interpersonal relationships they had, conversations with friends, hanging out, presence time with friends, being present with them. They got better grades on the tests they did, they read more, and they said they were happier. It seems kind of easy, right? But we got to have it. We got to do my thing, okay? So, two types of practitioners. Practitioners that come from faith, practitioners that come from analysis. Two types of practitioners. Often we're a bit of a mix. But just looking at how you come to things, one, a faithful practitioner is a person with complete trust in his or her teacher. Okay, they accept what the teacher says, they put it into practice. Okay, analytical practitioner questions a lot of things. They have doubts. Okay, they're not sure they're going to accept something. And then once they thoroughly have taken the doubts to the end, then they put it into practice. Both are fine. There's no problem. Okay, we're not about blind faith in this tradition. So I did say, please be discerning. Please investigate thoroughly what I am saying. Make sure, how does this really fit with your mind? Is this true what she's saying? You know, try an exercise. Does it help me? You know, a little bit, I was just curious if you discussed at lunch, how does the practice fit into your life? You have to get real with that. How is it going to fit into your life? You know, we're all on autopilot. I get that. I'm an American. I know this culture. So what happens? Can I not a little bit interrupt the autopilot to a little bit reflect on how my life's going? How are you doing? Are you relatively happy? Is your practice going the way you want? If you never want to consider and look at it, then I can't improve it. I just did this recently. I got to this retreat in Vermont, and I felt like I needed the pill. Remember in the beginning of meditation, I needed a new pill. Okay, I had my practice going for years, but I'm like, something's not satisfying me. It's a little stale. I'm doing what I'm supposed to be doing, but it's kind of rote. You know when it gets like that? You know when you're kind of, it's just, so I was a little bit like, you know, let me reevaluate. And it was very helpful to, and then I got something else going now, reinvigorated. And so it's really been very helpful right now to, but you need to kind of stop and evaluate and say, you know, I wonder if there's some priority I can readjust, right? And what are your priorities? Are you even aware of what they are to know that I'm going to lessen this, I'm going to borrow half an hour from this, and now I'm going to put it here? That's what I just did. I took a half an hour from something that I didn't think was really beneficial, and now it's in my practice. And I feel a lot better seeing the result. So, and all this is describing the two types of practitioners, just a way of identifying the different forces operating within us to generate an aspiration that invigorates your practice, an aspiration to achieve liberation and enlightenment. Okay, it also encourages us to use our faculties to develop a conviction that I can do this, that I can do this. So through the analysis, we come to ignorance. Well, what is ignorance? What's the problem? You know, and also when you do suffer, I mentioned in the early meditation is when you're suffering, can you get to the origin? In that meditation, what was happening for you? Anybody? Cause of the suffering? What was going on?
Expectations.
It's the expectations, right? Yeah. Causes you to suffer. I always find expectation is the mother of disappointment, isn't it? Right? So that's great to know that. And then you start to, a little bit from that, analyze what's realistic to have about an expectation. If I'm doing something, was I being realistic? Right? It starts to break it down. Where you start to, suddenly, as Lami Eshi said, you start to touch reality. That's where you get to the truth, right? A little bit. What other things came up for people? Start to analyze.
Cherishing the I.
Cherishing the I. Right? Our basic selfishness. Self-absorption. Helpful to see that. Like, so I noticed some things I tracked for a while is I kept kind of having this suffering, this low-grade suffering that would go on. In certain ways, I'd hit a wall, and then I was just like, it's just my self-absorption is what's going on there. Like each incident, I could go, oh, yeah, that was because it all just layered to the same thing. And so very helpful. So first of all, there's self-cherishing, which is the antithesis of bodhicitta. I just want to be clear about these two terms. Self-cherishing, more related, I say, to selfishness and self-absorption, is I'm more important than you. My agenda is more important than you. Self-grasping is different. Self-grasping, myself appears to be entirely prominent in the space, and then I'm hanging on to that. I'm going to grasp hold of that. And so anything that threatens that, I'm going to freak out and have some delusion arise. Self-cherishing, more selfishness, absorption, me, myself and I, what's in it for me? I'm just thinking about myself. I don't care what's going on for you. You're having a problem with a boss, somebody at work, somebody in your life, you know, and no consideration of them. But then from this, underneath that, underneath the self-absorption, is I've got a false idea of how I exist. And I'm riveted in that. That's self-grasping. Make sense? Are we communicating, as Lami Eshi would say? Are we communicating? Okay. So let's look at ignorance. Everybody says the problem is fundamental ignorance, is what we call it. The root of the suffering. Fundamental ignorance. Ignorance here, it's not a passive, I don't know. It's not a passive absence of knowledge. It's an active misknowledge of reality. This is the difference. An active misknowledge, a misknowing of reality. It's a mental event that wrongly engages an object. Okay, this is all new to a lot of us. Nobody in our culture is talking about this. Okay, everything's held from a very materialistic basis. That's our culture. And yes, we are brainwashed by it. Every time you turn on a TV, newspapers, commercial advertising, magazines, what kind of books do you read? The internet, oh my goodness, that it's telling you one thing. Telling you one thing. This eye, most important thing in the world, protect it, do whatever you can do to continue to promote and foster it. Okay. Active misknowledge, a misknowing. It apprehends an object wrongly, such that the object neither appears as it is, okay, nor is understood as it is. Basically, the way things appear are not the way they exist. And the way things exist are not the way they appear. So for instance, if you look, and this is one example, and I think this is from the Discovering Buddhism Home course. I took a little piece from that, a few pieces from that. If you look in your wallet and you see, it looks like I've got a 20 in my wallet, $20 bill. Okay? And then I'm going to go buy something. It's like 15 bucks. And I pull out, and then I'm like, you know, oh, it's a 10. Okay? So I've misapprehended that the 10 was a 20. Okay? My mind creates an illusion that there's a $20 bill there. Okay? It apprehended that the illusion, it didn't see it as an illusion, it saw that it was real. Okay? That misconception. Misconception. Okay? So that's different. Okay, that's a different from not knowing how much money's in my wallet. Okay, what we think of ignorance is I just don't know how much money's in my wallet. Okay, that's different. But real ignorance is I saw something, I thought it was a 20, well it wasn't, it was a 10, but I thought it was a 20. We misknow, actively misknow. And I respond from there. I'm going to pay with this, and then she's like, well it's a 10. Okay, I'm just giving a mundane example. This happens all the time. So the main function, one of the main functions of the mind, as we know, is to know. Is to know something. The mind is clear in knowing. One of its functions is it's aware of things. It knows things. Knowing means a way to apprehend or engage in an object. Usually knowing means a correct apprehension. We like to think so. Usually it means a correct apprehension, but there's other states of mind that are mistaken and misapprehend objects. So all of us survive by depending upon intelligence, and yet we also know we can be fooled. So therefore, we always make an effort to question perceptions and ideas, and we don't always accept certain appearances. We analyze. This is what we do in emptiness. We analyze. We analyze. Okay, so let me give you a way we're going to analyze. Let me try to break it down. And I like this kind of healthy skepticism. Buddhism asks this of you. You don't want to just sit there. You know, because she said it and she wears maroon and she doesn't have much hair, okay. No, you need a healthy skepticism. Okay, it provides you the space to analyze and question, but in a healthy way, not in a negative, doubtful way. Well, she's stupid and I don't really think that's... You don't want to get into the gossipy things of that. Healthy skepticism. Okay, what did she say? How does that really fit in my mind? It's important to discriminate what's real and what's false. Okay, now let me just try. We tried a little bit. I talked about the table on one level. I want to go a little bit deeper. Some of you have heard this before, I think. Maybe from... Okay, I'm just going to use a pen as an example. What is this? Okay, it's not a trick question. It's a pen, right? Now, we're Americans here. We've got a certain language, and people, I held this, some people said pen, okay? And look at this pen. This is quintessential pen, isn't it? Big pen? Yeah, is this like one of the first pens you used? For me, it's my favorite pen. I don't know why I love these pens, okay? They're just a basic pen. I'm always... concerned, you know, you go to Staples now, these big stores. I'm always worried the day they stop making these. There will be a day they don't make them anymore. And I'll be like, just a basic big pen. Okay, we got pen here. We want to analyze the pen. I'm just going to use this as your basis to analyze how things exist. Okay? And you might say, well, who cares how the pen exists? But I'm going to show you why it's important. Okay? We a little bit talked about the table. Now we have pen, and we have a convention, we have an agreement, is what that means, that this is a pen. And that means in our language, in this part of the world, as human beings with our consciousnesses, we all would identify this as a pen, as a writing implement. Okay. So what we want to do then, we interact and engage with the pen as that there's a more solidly existing pen there. And pen, yes, is a mundane thing that I'm using. But just to give you an idea. So I might say then, I'm kind of a little bit more fixated on this pen because I really like this pen. Okay, so if I want to loosen up that hold I have on the pen, why? So there's more space and peace in my mind. Let me analyze how the pen really exists because I'm kind of attached to the pen. Okay? So you look at the pen. And then one school as far as dependent arising, this pen arises due to other factors. And the first one says, again, what was the first one? First kind of rule of dependent arising. What do things depend on to come into existence? Cause and conditions. Causes and conditions. What does that mean? It means that in ancient days, people started recording things on cave walls, right? Writing, so to speak. Then it evolved. And then there were inkwells, and people made quills, and they were like, oh, we can use this thing, and look, it writes. And then modern days, somebody invented plastic and said, I'm going to make a factory and I'm going to make big pens and I'll make some money and sell them, mass produce them. These are all causes and conditions in how this pen comes here and arises and comes into being. Following me? Okay. Number two said, how does the pen come into existence? Based on its parts. Based on its parts. Well, let's look at the parts of the pen. So now I'm analyzing a little more deeply. Well, this is the cap. I'm going to call this the top. I'm going to call this the bottom. I'm going to call this the side. It also has a plastic tube. I think you're aware there's an ink cartridge inside of it. You know, you could even talk about the little metal thing at the top. You could call that the point of the pen. You could take out this little... Okay, you get the idea. We got the parts of the pen. Okay? So let's say I'm seeing, well, I see the parts. Okay, there's all these different parts. Okay? And then according to the highest school, the third way things arise in dependence on a label, the mind labeling. Okay? So what we're going to say according to the highest school, the most subtle approach is the parts come together in a certain configuration and it has to function like a pen. Okay, there has to be that conventional arrangement. Like, I'm not going to say, this is a pen. That doesn't work. It has to fit with the way we know conventionally pen. So I'm going to look at that, and I look at the parts. And then the highest school says, the parts create, constitute a basis that's called a valid basis of designation. A basis that I can label with my mind. That's what comes together. That's what has to exist there, is a valid basis of designation. Saying valid means this is not a pen. This is not a valid basis of designation of pen for my mind. Okay? So I've got to have a valid basis of designation, and that's what's coming into my mental consciousness right now as my eye consciousness takes in this data. Okay. Those parts come together in a certain configuration, and I'm going to call now the valid basis of designation, follow me for a second, a plastic cylindrical tube filled with ink that writes. A plastic cylindrical tube filled with ink that writes. That's a basis of designation. That's really what's there on one level. My mind sees that data. Plastic cylindrical tube filled with ink that writes, and based on the karmic seeds, propensities I planted in my mind stream in this life and past lives with my body, speech, and mind, create the ability in me to then place a label on the valid basis of designation. Pen. My mind labels pen, and the pen comes into existence. On an ultimate level, there is no inherently existent pen there at all. Okay? Because, let me go back, inherent existence, we talked a little bit about those synonyms last night. Let me give you the synonyms again, and we're going to come back to the pen. Inherent nature. intrinsic existence, concrete reality, independent existence, existing with its own character from its own side. They're synonyms. Okay? And they're indicating a concrete, immovable, permanent, unchanging entity. Okay? Inherent existence. That's the way we tend to engage with things and with ourselves and with others. That there's a concrete, reified, I'm going to use the word reified, means like a concrete, concretizing entity. That's how we interact with everything, okay? Especially ourselves, okay? So, there's no inherently existent pen there at all, okay? Inherent existence implies the thing is unchanging, and it's always that thing for all beings. It didn't come from anything else. Inherent existent things don't come from anything else. It's like they're frozen in time and space. They're always those things. Solidly existent pen. For all beings. Inherent existent means it exists that way for all beings. If I throw this on the floor and a dog walks in the room, it's a chew toy. There's no inherently existent pen. There is a conventional pen there that I pick up and I say pen, and I say hand me the pen, you hand me this, and I write with it. Okay? So there is, you have to have that existence, that there is something there. You do exist. You do exist. But how do I exist? Amy labeled on to a configuration of my body and mind. My five aggregates that form my body and mind. One form aggregate, my body, and four mental aggregates. That's me. Okay? If Amy was inherently existent, which is often the way I take myself, concretely existing, permanent me, important, pay attention, here I am. I was born in a hospital. When I came out in the delivery room, if inherently existing Amy came out, everyone in the delivery room would know it's Amy. They didn't. What came out was baby girl. Then, according to that configuration, my parents put a label on the valid basis of designation, which was a fleshy being with a round oblong thing here and a long torso thing with four appendages, and that came out, and then they said it was female, and then they said Amy. And then Amy came into existence. Are you following? Okay, it's an interesting way to break stuff down. Okay, how do we see things? Now you go, well, so what? So what? So the pen's there. So you got a cylindrical plastic tube filled with ink that writes, my mind takes in the data, and I label pen on that. So what? What's the problem? That's not really the problem, the misknowing. The problem is when I misknow and I engage from there and then I say, my pen. That's where all your suffering starts. Soon as I get territorialship, ownership, mine, I suffer. That's the root of it right there. That's the problem. That's why you want to analyze. So when you get angry, perfect opportunity. Get angry at somebody. You know, and maybe they really threaten you. The hardest part is when somebody's physically in your face attacking you at that moment. Or verbal or emotional, severe verbal or emotional abuse. And you're in it. So we can't do that sometimes in the face of it. Let's be practical. Go back to your cushion. And in our everyday world, basically, you have a fight with somebody during the day. You know, somebody at work, anybody have anybody irritating in their life right now? No. Of course we do. Somebody irritate you. That's what we want to work with. That's what emptiness is perfect for. Insight into emptiness. Analysis. We want to be that student. I want to show up with my analysis now. I'm a practitioner. I've got some faith in this. I think it works. It creates so much merit for your mind to think about emptiness, discuss emptiness. Okay? And now I'm really pissed off at this person. And you know what? Right now, I can't deal with them. Back on my cushion. Oh, what happened today? Right? There's your work. What happened? You stop right there. Okay. Go into the situation. Bring it up in your mind. Right? You might immediately start feeling angry again. Great. Hold on to that. Notice how the anger, first of all, moves through your body. It's very uncomfortable, isn't it? Yeah. You can feel sometimes heart increasing, blood pressure. You know, you see people angry, their face gets red. They look sometimes contorted, not pleasant. So first allow it, feel it in your body. What's going on? I don't want to really feel this. It doesn't feel good. Okay, great. Stay there with it. Okay, now start to analyze a little bit. Take a couple deep breaths to sort of get a little clarity in the mind. What's going on? Well, I wanted this. Anybody give me an example? Anybody want to reveal an example? Somebody pissing them off? I know it's a little revealing. Yes. Karen? I know. David, you may want to just take it out in the hall right now, right?
Yeah, because you...
Thank you.
Yeah, because usually that's when I feel the most self-righteous and deserving of being angry, right? But, oh, thank you. So recently I had somebody that was helping with the project and now isn't going to help. And so I have to change my schedule to be able to do something, and I became really upset. And then when I sat with it, I kept thinking, why was I so irritated and upset? Because I didn't get what I wanted, a night off, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So it was very apparent then.
Yes. Yeah. And so here I go back. Perfect example. I go back, and David's really happy. It's not about him. Okay. And we go.
How do you know?
I go back to my cushion, you know. So great insight to say, well, it was all about my agenda. It usually is. Okay. And sometimes we have a valid perception about it that this was important for me. We had an agreement that I was going to take the night off and you had a responsibility, and some people shirk responsibility. Okay? But remember, this is samsara. That means people shirk responsibility. Right? And then I might say to myself, have I ever done that? Mm-hmm. I have. Did I ever weasel my way out of something when, you know, I did. Yeah, I did. You know? And then Rinpoche's thing is everything comes from the mind. So rather than blaming out there, can I take responsibility here? It's a bigger step. Can I take responsibility here to realize I've done that? I created the cause for this, actually. This is what Buddhism says. If I'm suffering now as a result of this, I'm purifying the cause. Could be purifying the cause. And let's look a little deeper. Do I know the whole scene going on for the other person that inconvenienced me? Did you know the scene?
I made it my own story.
Right. Perfect. So we make a story. When I got irritated, I immediately had a story. Jerk. Stupid head. I'm never speaking to them again. Whatever your things are. We suddenly, I'm projecting, okay, from a mistaken perception, I just vomit a whole thing out there onto them in my irritation. We talk about blind rage. I'm not seeing clearly in anger. You're not seeing very clearly. And now I impose a story out there. Okay. So now I'm going to sit in my seat. How accurate is my story? Let me look at the story I got going. They're stupid. Are they really stupid? Usually not. Okay. But it's just a reaction. Okay. Maybe you didn't have a chance to talk to the person and you find out their kid got sick. They've been totally freaked out about financial things the last month, and they just really couldn't do this right now. They're nervous about doing the job. They didn't feel that they could handle it, but they don't want to say that. They're embarrassed to say it. They wanted to cancel 10 days ago in enough time for you to do it, but they felt intimidated by you. I mean, there could be you know what I'm saying? There's many, many, something suddenly came up in their life, or they feel really ill, but they haven't communicated it. There's many variables, right? There's many variables. What if we give them some space? You know, realizing I've done this before. You know, if something, now this is not about laying down in the face of social injustice. Bodhisattvas are not doormats or enablers or codependents. We're familiar with those terms, right? Those are unhealthy states. So if the person does it for the third time, I'm going to get wise. I'm going to use my wisdom. Okay, but I'm always asking you, please, to motivate from compassionate wisdom. That means if they do it a second and third time, I might be very clear, and then we're going to have a little talk. I'm just wondering, first of all, from compassionate wisdom is, how are you doing? You see the difference then, like, you know, you did this again. You know, all of a sudden I'm attacking. But it's more like, let's create a healthy relationship between me and the person to find out, I wonder what inspires them or motivates them to continue to do this. If I know the answer to that, then I might have a better way of working with them. Okay? So a little bit start off where you might need to take a few deep breaths. How's it going? And they might immediately from there realize their space and say, I'm so sorry, I know I keep doing this to you, but suddenly a healthy dialogue started. You're talking, you're communicating. If you attack them, they're going to retreat, they're never going to open up. This is just practical stuff. Start, what's going on? You can set clear boundaries. Okay, you hear what's going on for them, you believe it, you don't believe it, whatever's going on, and just say, you know, listen, I'll tell you what, we need to make a new deal of how we're going to do this. How we're going to do this dance, you know, because I really need next week, I'm going out of town, I'm not going to be here. So I just want to know, are you going to show up? Are you going to be here? Are you going to do this? Are you going to get the project in on time? Are you going to do the things? We have an agreement. Do you understand what I'm saying, or am I not expressing myself clearly enough? Is there a better way for you to hear the instructions? Do you understand the instructions? But it's got to come from the compassionate wisdom, so it's a spacious place. And with the space, the person, you know, you're giving them the best opportunity to open up and start some healthy relationship. The more healthy relationships we can create on the planet, the harmony goes from there. We have enough fragmented relationships on the planet, right? Okay, so this is, again, this is an inner connected and interrelated reality. That's what we're operating in. If I don't want to see this person again not supporting me and not doing what they're supposed to do, I need to dismantle the cause in here. It's in here. It's not out there. Because you'll keep revisiting it with other people if I'm still wrapped up in here. Do you understand what I mean? It's from the mind side. It's not out there. Our world is pointing the finger out. It's everybody else's fault. And with vengeance, they go about, and that's why there's war on the planet. Okay? So this is very, very much of, I'm going to take responsibility. I know the rest of the world may not be. Your compatriots at work are not Buddhists necessarily. Your family are not Buddhists. So what do I do when I'm not around Buddhists and they're not doing the work? You just keep doing the work. You keep picking yourself up. Spiritual practice for me is two steps forward, one step back. Two steps forward. I just keep moving ahead, though, okay, with some insight, humility, let's hope, and trying to understand reality directly, trying to understand what's really happening, meaning I have a relationship here to participate as harmoniously as possible with compassionate wisdom. And every time I respond from there, I'm making positive seeds in my consciousness that will project happier moments for me in the future. So now the niggling person's come up at work. Well, that's got to be creation of some negative karma I've put in my mind stream, negative seeds I've planted. It's the only reason they're there. I'd like them to go away permanently. I'd like this situation never to arise again. How do I do it? Take responsibility for your mind. You know, responding from a good motivation, gently, with compassion and kindness. Try it. Now, granted, some of us don't have any pattern of that. As soon as someone attacks you, right? The worst is when they attack our kids. Something happens to your kid and it's created by somebody else. Okay, but it's the same thing. So what you want to do is start practicing with easier moments in your life, little things. Your friend, you make a lunch date with somebody, friend of yours. At the last minute, she cancels. Okay, so you're inconvenienced, you're a little tweaked, and you go, well, you know, something came up, I've done that. Let it go, okay? You do the same thing, you make plans again, and she cancels again at the last minute. Now I'm a little angrier, okay? So how do I want to deal with it? Maybe I'll talk to them. What happened? You know, it's the second time this happened, and I canceled some other... Just explain gently. I canceled some other plans to be with you. So I'm just wondering if we... Like, I'd like to make plans again. She wants to make plans again. Okay, well, what I'd like to know is, can I count on you? I want to count on you. I really want to see you. We're trying to make it as positive as possible. Yeah. I had this with a friend that happened a couple years ago. Her life is a mess. It's really sad. She's not functioning that well. So immediately a little bit my insight was like, okay, so this is going to need a little tending, right? Well, I'm on the Bodhisattva path. I'm on the Mahayana path. That's what we're here for, is to help people. Okay? So we made plans. She broke it at the last minute. We made a second date. She broke it at the last minute. I haven't seen her in a long time. So the third time we made plans, I made sure that I was in a space where I was just doing my stuff, whether she came or not, it didn't matter. I was doing my thing. It was just the way I decided that was a skillful thing for me to do. You know, she didn't show up. She didn't come. I had my thing. It was okay. And sometimes that happens with people. Again, placing it in samsara, where that means your plans are going to be inconvenienced, people are not going to show up, people are going to attack you, suffering occurs. You know, so understanding the nature of samsara, but also please know you can get out of samsara. Don't just leave it in samsara. It's not good enough for us. One, I'm striving to try to get out of that mess at some point. But right now, it's a broken situation. That means people cancel plans, people bully your kids, like that. And that your kid has a seed to be bullied in their mind stream that creates them to be bullied if the bullying bothers them. Mostly it bothers them, right? But you and your kid would have that seed planted in your consciousness that would create that situation. Okay. What about a real physical attack, which is rare? I hope it never happens to you. What do you want to do with that? You can't sometimes do anything in the moment. The main thing I would try to do is get out of the way if I can with as little reverberation as possible of attacking anyone back. Or can you do something that's going to create the less harm for the most people? Okay. Can you run? Can you scream? Can you call somebody like that? And sometimes you might inflict other harm in a less urgent way for them that might have prevented them from, but you have to be very skillful. But otherwise afterwards, back to the cushion. You know, and maybe you need to get other counseling and things to support that. Back to the cushion, but looking at that, you know, what happened in the situation rather than just hating out there. People attack because they're miserable. They don't understand. They don't understand. Sometimes they're mentally ill. Sometimes they're on drugs and alcohol. That's, there's many different reasons that occur, misconceptions and things. So I hope that doesn't happen, but just looking at how destructive emotions get activated. Okay. And so again, we have to exercise this. Exercise. The mind is like many faculties, can be improved by use. Can be improved by use. It gets stronger the more we use it. Those of you aging, you know this saying, use it or lose it. Right? My knees are not great. The more I move them, the better they are. Any kind of arthritic conditions. If you sit there, they're just going to tighten up, stiffen up. Use it or lose. Same with the mind. Same with the mind. Exercise the mind. It can become weaker if you prefer to engage in your fantasy of the misknowing. Okay? When you go further and further away from reality. How do we do it? Turn on the TV. It's a great way to do it. You know. Now, I know sometimes we want breaks. Right? American crime, right? I'm telling these guys, we want breaks, but be skillful. Be skillful about the breaks. They're breaks. They're short things. If you ask Lama Zopa Rinpoche one time, you know, Rinpoche with diabetes and things, he's supposed to take rest when he teaches. He doesn't like to do that. Came to our center, was teaching a lot, and the attendant's like, he needs a break. So I said, well, Rinpoche, please come into this room. I thought Rinpoche could take a break. Rinpoche looked at me. He said, there's no break from samsara. That's Rinpoche, okay? So, again, you know, some highly realized being, but it's something to think about. How am I using my breaks? In a more skillful way? Okay? Again, Dharmakirti, the innate function of the mind, according to Dharmakirti, is to apprehend things as they are. This is what I keep talking about. And as long as we are capable of the mistakes of misknowing, this fundamental ignorance, we're also capable of accurate knowledge, of penetrating to see how things are the case. That's why we're able to get enlightened. Okay, that's not we're not stuck with the misknowing. Okay. So let me talk a little bit about destructive emotions, how emptiness then gets them activated, which is a little bit what I'm talking about. Is, so when you're in the face of someone is walking toward you, in fact, this is our practice from Pema Chodron, your practice is whatever's walking toward you at any given time. This is life, right? You're faced with all kinds of people. And meaning, you can be in your car driving. What are the other cars doing? How do you practice in your car? Some of you are maniacs, right? Right? It's amazing. It's amazing. Just a vehicle. So what happens is, I'm just going to take a person walking towards you. Okay? Can we do this in here before another class? Got a person walking towards you. Let's analyze. Okay? Let's analyze. You have sometimes incredible attachment gets activated, right? Like you see them and, I don't know if any of you remember long ago maybe when you fell in love. Remember the last time you fell in love? Maybe it's recent. Okay? Or maybe it's when you look at your kid. Here comes your kid. How do you feel about that? Okay. What about somebody you don't like? About somebody you don't like. Look at politics right now. Right? It's the antithesis of my life. Right? The absolute antithesis of what I'm doing on the planet right now. It's called utter duality. Emptiness is non-duality. Okay? So be careful about stuff. I used to work in politics, okay? Right? Unbelievable. But this utter duality, so this is the way they get us, is this person's good, this person's not good, this person's good, this is, okay, here's the person. Maybe I turned on my TV, here's the person. Maybe I'm in my car, here comes another car. Or here comes another car not signaling, getting in front of me. It could be anything like that. But let's look at the person. Okay? Okay, let's analyze. I just got pissed off at this person. What happened? Well, let me see what I'm really seeing. Well, I've got this fleshy oblong thing here. Okay, it's got a hole here. Sometimes out of the hole comes sound. And here there's these two things that are colored. And there's some material here. And then there's a longer torso thing that's covered in some kind of material. And off of that are four appendages. Here they come. Okay, that's the raw data, right? You following? That's the raw data that's coming towards me. This is how karma and emptiness comes together. In here I've got karmic seeds firing. Ripening, coming to fruition, means all the same thing. Okay, I thought, said, and did things in the past, and that's left imprints in my consciousness. And right now, one of them is activated that's unpleasant. Why is it there? I did something negative in the past, and now it's coming up as suffering for me, and I'm experiencing this person. Coming in contact, fleshy oblong thing, some sounds coming out, this thing, and the appendages. There they are, boom, in front of me. I'm not liking it. What's happening? My karmic seeds are projecting a fantasy out there that's underestimating the reality. Anger underestimates the reality. Not seeing clearly what's there, which is simply a human being just like me who wants to be happy and doesn't want to suffer. A human being just like me who has Buddha nature. Buddha nature doesn't mean they're a Buddha. It means they have a potential that can awaken into a fully realized being. Just like me. Me and this person have two things in common. You might say, well, they have a different way going about their happiness and avoiding suffering. Then, fair enough, but fundamentally, we want to be happy, we don't want to suffer. Here they are, right? And actually, I don't know anything about them. I don't know what their hopes and fears are. I don't know what motivates them. Maybe they do have a kind heart, but I'm underestimating right now, and then I don't like. And that's how anger and hatred get fueled. An underestimation of the reality that is created by the karmic seeds of negative imprints from the past, negative activities I have put in my mind. So then I respond from there. There's the negative, destructive emotion of anger, hatred. Okay, now, attachment, desire. Here comes the person. Same data that's there. And now I've got karmic seeds ripening of some pleasant seed I planted with my body, speech, and mind in the past that now is ripening in some pleasurable experience for me. that causes me to vomit a projected fantasy onto the data, onto the raw data, that overestimates what's out there. And now I like that and I want to have it. Bring me more of that. So whatever sound comes out of that opening here is very pleasant and wonderful and seductive and sweet and soft and great. The negative seeds ripening, whatever, that's really what's there. But then I interpret it as something negative and horrid. Stupid. Right? Are you following? Everybody with me? Okay. So a little bit how the destructive emotions, those are the three poisons. Fundamental ignorance, the misknowing of the raw data and what's there, my interpreting onto it, and layering this gauze of obscuration on top of it causes the other two poisons to get fueled. Anger, hatred, or attachment, desire. And those are the three animals that they represent in the center of the Wheel of Life Tanka. Okay? You have a pig that's fundamental ignorance. The real way the Tanka should be painted is out of the mouth of the pig is a snake that is hatred, anger, and is a rooster that's attachment, desire. And those are, again, the three poisons or the three poisonous states of mind. And then they're three of the six root delusions. Continuing on with pride, doubt, and wrong view. And then basically all the other negative emotions branch from those. So for instance, if you take two parts attachment, one part anger, you get jealousy. So again, three poisons, fundamental ignorance, hatred, anger, number two, number three, attachment, desire, are three of the six root delusions, and then you add pride, doubt, and afflicted views, wrong views, six root delusions. Pride, we know it, is not like to your kid, I'm so proud of you. That's different. It's a puffed up, haughty notion. I'm better than you. Seeing myself as superior. Arrogance comes from this. We know that. Haughtiness is another experience of that. Doubt is not discernment. When I asked you to please investigate thoroughly, doubt is more of that niggling kind of computer virus. It doesn't check up thoroughly. If you investigate your doubt to the end, then you're convinced one way or another. If you don't, it just kind of sits there eating away at everything. So every view, you're kind of like, I don't know, I'm not really sure about her. Oh, she said that, that's stupid. Now look what she's doing. She's doing that. Now she's doing, where I'm not really thoroughly checking why I'm feeling these ways about somebody. What's really accurate? That's doubt. Wrong views I mentioned last night. You know, cigarette smoking is good for your health. That's the wrong view. With our philosophy, it would be, I don't believe in karma. I think that's garbage. That would be holding a wrong view. As opposed to, I'm not sure about karma, so I'm just going to put it over here for now. I like this stuff about Buddhism. I'm going to pursue that. And maybe later I'll check on karma and come back to that. Because right now I'm not sure. That's different. That's being discerning. Okay? So notice these things. You can play with them a little bit. For instance, did you ever have a situation in your office? You don't like somebody, right? Do other people like the person? You found somebody else likes them. Amazing, isn't it? How do they like them? They're such a jerk. Right? That's just your view. Just your view. Now, some of your view, I'm not totally laying a trip on you, some of your view has a valid perspective. You see something. Yeah. You see somebody hit somebody like this. And suddenly you're like, whoa, I have a valid perspective. I saw the hand go. I heard the smack. Right? But you didn't know they're kind of horsing around. I didn't get the whole, I have a valid perspective, but it's not the whole truth. And also, until you've had a direct perception of emptiness, my view is limited. Not only that, my story, as you said, Karen, I get a story going. My story is always wrong until I've had a direct perception of emptiness. I found that liberating. Because I'll get a story going like that, and now I'm very quick to say, well, that's quite a story, quite a saga I've just marched out there. I wonder if there's any truth to that. Is it accurate? I'm often asked myself, is that really accurate? Is that the whole story? My dad's view, there's three sides to every story, right? Yours, mine, and the truth. Right? It's like that. You have some perspective on it, but so introduce some space to yourself that there's often another side. Could there be another side? It'll give you a lot of space in your mind when you're dealing with destructive emotions. So recently, this is from my friend Peter over here. Sorry, I told him I was going to pick on him. Okay. He drove me today, and we were talking about things. But this is for everybody. So I'm from a really musical family, and I love music, and sometimes I listen to music in my car, and so there'll be like whatever the new pop song is. And now there's this new pop song. I wish I put it on my phone because I could play it for you, because I don't think I can sing it very well. But it's probably a standard song about relationship gone wrong. Isn't that what they're all about anyway? Right? And kind of, you know, love and attachment. But I thought you can interpret it in a different way. Destructive emotions get going. I understand I'm not seeing emptiness, not seeing things, you know, clearly, the misknowing, whatever. But sometimes there's a way of, in that space, can you recognize, I just mentioned, you have Buddha nature. You have Buddha nature, and that means you have a potential. Every being with a mind has it. Okay, down to a single cell organism, they say has Buddha nature, it's from the Buddha, that I have a potential that can ripen into a fully realized being. And everybody has that. All of you have that. So we're fundamentally good. That's what Buddhism says. Some of us have been raised in a different way. Okay, that somewhere in the beginning, Buddhism doesn't have a beginning anyway, but in the beginning something went very, very wrong. Right? And it was our fault. I found that really heavy, frankly. Right? I mean, I wasn't raised as a Catholic, but I lived in a Catholic area, and one of the churches in our area had a very large Jesus hanging on a cross outside. And as a kid, I was fascinated every time we drove by that church. You know, I was always like, you know, what happened to him? I wanted to know. I wasn't really raised Christian, so I was really like, you know, what went down there? Something really heavy. I was very intimidated by it. And, you know, his real teaching was about loving kindness. That's what Jesus is about. That was why I think he was trying to give us that message, okay? But then human nature takes over with all of our religions, how we were raised, and it tries to control in a different way, right? So what if you just start with everybody's fundamentally good? Now, you say Osama bin Laden, and okay, but because of grave misknowings, destruction and violence happens. It's just about grave misknowings. He has Buddha nature. He had Buddha nature, just like me. Right? And some of these people, I know some people would talk about a certain politician. You all have your alignments, and you get kind of like, well, this is the great best guy. This is the great guy. Okay, so I know some circles that we might say this particular president was awful, you know, and we had him for so many years, and people would make jokes, or this person, or whatever. But I think if you really sat down with this person on a personal level, probably okay person. You know, but we don't go to that level. You know, now granted, you don't have to agree with people's policies. You have friends you don't agree with how they raise their kids or what kind of job they're doing, but you like them as a person. Right, but we never want to see through that with certain people that we're alienated from. So this is kind of our job as Buddhists. So what if everyone's fundamentally good? So back to this song, is things get churned up for you. You know, so can I come back to, I may not be seeing everything perfectly. I've got a misknown. I'm not laying a trip on myself. I'm just saying this is the reality. In samsara, I'm fundamentally good, so is this person. And these are the lyrics of the song. I don't know if any of you heard of this. Let it go, let it be, so you can just be you and I can just be me. Right? Like, it's sweet. It's kind of like, you know, meaning I can just be here with my Buddha nature and you're there with your Buddha nature. That's how I chose to interpret it. Like, I'm going to give you the space for that, because in that space, when we are truly us, me and my transcendental me, right? You okay there? When you're being essentially who you really are, is what I'm saying. When you He's got it. Okay. When you are being essentially really who you are, okay, that's that space of the Buddha nature where everything's okay. So you're fighting with somebody, certainly those most intimate to you, this is often we get these little sniggling things. Okay, I'm just going to recognize that in you. You know, so just let it go, let it be in that space. Find that space to let it go, let it be. I'm not talking about in the face of social injustice again. Bodhisattvas have a responsibility to take action, but sometimes you're, can I take a deep breath right now? And like, and even the letting going, letting being, then I'm going to find my way with compassionate wisdom to now address and engage with the person. See what I mean? Rather than reaction, reactive response, which often fosters the negativity or the attachment, the grasping, like that. So I like that song recently. I was listening to it. I drove up and down, you know, Vermont. I was like, you know, let it go. Right, okay. So it was helpful. You know, you can interpret what you want. I don't know what the song, again, it's probably about some destructive relationship, but I've just imputed my thing. Okay. And also, how do we communicate thinking about emptiness? How do we communicate? Do you have presence? Do you have presence? Please bring presence. And so recently, a magazine article, I can't remember the magazine. It was a good magazine, though. I read, they did a survey, when are you happiest? Did I talk about this last year? When are you happiest? Meaning deeply happy. I'm not talking about a superficial, you know, you teach in Europe and everyone's like, Americans always want to be happy. That's what they think of us, right? So when are you deeply happy? Meaning deep contentment, like that. So when any ideas of what lends to your deep contentment? There were two of the highest responses. Many things were in this, like helping others, being with family and friends, enjoying a good meal, you know, helping people. But there were two that got the highest. Any ideas? Any guesses? When you achieve the goals, that was on the list. That wasn't the two top, but that was on the list. That's a good one. Any other ideas?
Helping others.
That was on the list. That was on the list.
That's what I was going to say. When you're helping others,
that was definitely on the list that I mentioned.
That wasn't
the two top. Yeah.
Really, it's celebrating another being's presence. I mean, like, okay, I have a dog.
My dog makes me deeply. I get deep contentment from observing my dog being a dog when he's out in the backyard.
And what are you doing when you're doing that?
I'm being present.
You're being present. That was one of them.
Oh, okay.
Being present. Thank you. You know, when you're really present, how often are you really present? Something to, you know, that's one thing. The other one was gratitude. When you feel gratitude. We tried that little meditation in the beginning, reminding, when you feel grateful. Check up. Try it out. Just notice when you're, you know, we can get up, and I see people get up, wake up in the morning, We have so much to be grateful for in this culture. Oh, unbelievable. Look at us in the room. Look at what we have. Look at who we are. Right? You have many good qualities. It's cause for celebration. Seriously. We have it so good right now. So many, many things. And being present. So here's your intimate loved one. I think I did this last time. Here's your intimate loved one. How many of you have partners? Many, many of you, right? Live with people. Great, right? When they speak to you, you live with them. Maybe 30 years you're with them. So they talk. Sometimes what you hear is this accurate? I don't know. What you hear, they're speaking, and what you hear is, and then later they say, but I told you, and then you say, no, you didn't. Yes, I did. No, you didn't. And then, boom. Are we listening? Right? You got the syllables in there, but I didn't hear a word they said. Do you ever try practicing active listening with your loved one? We do it in work. We're educated. We have to. What about your loved one? Those most intimate with you. I think I gave this example last time. I was working at Milarepa. Worked with this very capable woman. I just saw her. We just got together with her and her partner. Wonderful woman. Good manager. And we were so busy. We're about the same age and we're friends. We were always doing many, many things. Maureen knows her, right? Many things. So I thought, I'm not really listening to her very well. And we talked about it. I thought, I really want to listen to her better. So we're in the kitchen, country kitchen, big wooden counter in the middle. I'm cooking. She's doing the dishes behind me. Our backs are to each other. And she's talking about something important, I thought. She's talking. And I thought, you know, I'm just going to listen to her. I turned the burner off, turned around on the table, just like this, watching her, making sure I was really hearing what she was saying, because we'd often had like little misunderstanding, and she's like, that's not what I meant. And so I was like really trying to, and I would actually repeat back and say, oh, so you meant you felt like you were being ignored by this person, and she didn't see me watching. She was just, what, you know, she's like, yeah, I felt like that. So I'm listening. She stops, dries her hands, turns around, and she sees me like this. And then she said, what's wrong? Right? And then I said to her, this is my offering. But I said to her, oh, I'm just listening. And it melted her. That was my offering to her. Like, I'm just going to listen to you. Like, how often do you... Okay, so check up. It's a little exercise you can play with your loved ones. That, you know, so I get to spy on Karen and David because I stay with them now. So, but it's just an exercise, because that's where people, the communication breaks down, and then I assume something, you know, and I put words in your mouth and I think that I know what you mean, and I've missed it totally. It's not at all what you're talking about. Or I didn't even hear you at all. Yeah. And then there's also little snippy remarks that come out, perhaps. Right, with the people that we love the most. They're the ones we can take a little bit leeway with. Okay, so I have these two friends. Maybe I mentioned this before. They've been together, I don't know, 30 years. They have a really good relationship. They don't have any kids. And I've gone to visit them and stayed with them. And I was with them, staying with them. And he was trying to get out the door to go to work. I don't know if I told you this one before. And he was in a rush. And I could see the tension kind of mounting. And he couldn't find something, a paper that he needed, and she's running around looking, and he's then, and they start a little bit snipping, you know, a little bit barbs at each other. I notice this little thing. And then he really lobs one on her about, well, if you hadn't done the, something. And she turned around, not really, I didn't feel much anger from her, she turned around, and she said, she looked at him, and I'm right in the room, and she looked at him and she said, what I heard you say was blah, 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 blah. But what I think you meant was, I'm really stressed right now trying to get out the door. I can't find the report. I know you're helping me look, and I appreciate that. So let's see if we can figure out where it is, or I'll leave without it and figure out plan B. She throws that up. And that was their engagement of how they would work on the barbs. And it caught him immediately. He caught it. You know, it was called the blah, blah, blah thing that they worked out. And I saw him transform, and he went, you're absolutely right. Like he said, I do appreciate what you're doing, and I'm sorry if I was tense, and let's figure out what we need to do. That was the end of it. And then I saw him do it to her another time when she got snippy with him. And he just, you know, so it was kind of amusing. I mean, but we all laughed at the end of it. And I went, you guys are amazing. And they go, well, that's what we do. We just try to counter. So create something from your own space of how to counter those things when your misknowing takes over, and then I'm starting to respond from there. Okay? Let's go back to the pen for a minute. How do I want to know the pen so I can cut my grasping or aversion? And again, pen is mundane, but you can relate it then to your kid, to yourself. Okay. I said there's a plastic. And also, is everybody following so far? Is this helpful for people? Any questions where we are? Yes.
I'm kind of getting stuck on this one thing.
Maybe
it's okay.
Is that better?
Yeah. So it's something you said.
Uh-oh. I'm always like...
Well, I think you said it. I'll put it that way, right? And that is that... yeah, you perceive the pen.
Yep.
I'm just, you know, right? And then you grasp the pen, and that's unknowing. Is that what you were saying? Because I don't see how that's
annoying. I'll put it this way. When I have a misknowing of the pen...
A misknowing. Yeah.
That can create me... Because I'm misinterpreting how the pen exists, and then as a result, it causes me...
Causes you to...
To then say mine.
Okay.
Mine.
Right.
It's not just the grasping, it's my pen.
Yeah.
So if you threaten this pen, I'm going to get angry at you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, due to my attachment to the pen, my misknowing of the pen.
So it's the misknowing that causes the grasping.
Yes.
Okay. That,
absolutely.
Because I was stuck. I said, I don't understand how that, you know, grasping is misknowing.
Yeah. But it's the misknowing causes the grasping.
Yeah. Okay. Good. Now I'm clear now. I was stuck for a long time.
Okay. Okay. Let me go back, and then I'd like to do a brief meditation on emptiness from Venerable Sangye Kadro, how to meditate, just to give you a little bit. We're going to do more tomorrow as well. The morning class is a different class. Is everyone aware of that? It's kind of a general class. What I want to do tomorrow morning is I'm going to use something from Pema Chödrön, and thank you, because Donna gave me some ideas of what Geshe-la does, but I'm going to do it a little bit differently, and then I also want to... When I mentioned how these great masters would take their teachings and further synthesize, and this is something you can do, is study the teachings. You've got a great, great scholar here, Geshe-la, and also Geshe Sangpo. Take the teachings and further synthesize. You might have disagreements. You might have a new interpretation of something. Then you start to work it out in your own way. And so one of my friends just created a new book. I think you have it here in the bookstore. It's called The Beautiful Way of Being. And Venerable Rene, a close friend of mine, he's really a great yogi. And he took Master Shantideva's, the Bodhisattva's Way of Life, and kind of reinterpreted the verses and then has some meditations on them in the back. So I may read a verse or two from there. It's a really beautiful book that came out from Wisdom Publications this past year. I highly recommend it. So that'll be tomorrow morning, and then tomorrow afternoon we'll conclude the emptiness topic like that, the emptiness course. So back to this, we'll get some little bit of time to meditate. We've got, again, let me go back, cylindrical plastic tube filled with ink that writes, okay? My mind takes in the raw data, takes in that information of cylindrical plastic tube filled with ink that writes. There's a gap, okay, for me seeing the raw data, okay, interpreting it from my karmic propensities so that my mind then labels pen on the valid basis of designation. There's a gap before of the labeling process. My ignorance covers over the gap. So what I do then is I glom together the valid basis of designation, a plastic cylindrical tube filled with ink that writes, with an inherently existent pen that appears for my consciousness. When my mind labels pen on that, an inherently existent pen comes in to being for me that causes me to say my pen, my car, my kid, my husband, my house, my wife, like that, where the suffering begins. There's a gap, again, of the labeling process that my ignorance covers over. So I'm not realizing that my mind's seeing data and labeling it according to the highest school, the most subtle exploration, the most subtle interpretation of how things come into existence. Again, a conventional pen does exist by depending on causes and conditions. People started writing, wanted to record things, mass-producing plastic, making pens, making factories for pens. It comes into existence based on its parts, independence, by depending, all the same words, by depending on its parts, top, plastic tube, sides, bottom, ink, like that. And according to the highest school, it comes into existence by depending on the mind labeling on pen, labeling pen on a valid basis of designation. According to Lama Zopa Rinpoche, okay, you take pen, and my mind places pen on this configuration, on this raw data, okay, and then an inherently existent pen appears to my consciousness. That's the misknowing. Doesn't exist like that at all. but an inherently existent, a concrete existing pen for all time, unchanging, independent, appears to my consciousness, because I do not have a direct perception of emptiness. And this is Lama Zopa Rinpoche. And then you trust that. Meaning, I believe in that. And that is a complete hallucination. That's the source of all the suffering. So once again, let me put it with the I, my sense of self. Okay? We cart around this sense of self. Me, myself, and I, dominant and prominent in the universe, in my space. On a conventional level, I need to take care of myself. That's okay. You need to get yourself dressed, cleaned every day, feed yourself, go to work, take care of your families. No problem at all with any of that. But how do I want to do that? What's my attitude doing that? It's me for all time at the expense of you? Then I'm misknowing. Then I've missed the point. Okay? I've got this conventional I that exists, Amy exists, labeled on my body and mind. You could break it down and say American, female, none, whatever, and then label Amy on that. That's me, and I need to take care of that. Okay? But if I'm any more dominant, permanent, existing, like that, but what happens is that sense of myself appears. That sense of myself arises. Okay, and Rinpoche is like, and you trust that. That motors me through every experience I have every day. I trust that. And he said, that is a complete hallucination. Okay? So my I, this is further what Rinpoche says, my I, my sense of self, becomes decorated by my ignorance. Okay? This is Rinpoche's new way. It used to be the table. But now it's you trust that, and that my sense of I and myself is decorated by my ignorance. You know, when you decorate something, you're covering over the raw data that's there. Okay? And I experience a concretely, inherently existing sense of self. So anything that interferes with that, you know. You're in the parking lot. This has happened many times, I'm sure. You're in the parking lot. Right? Do you ever see in the parking lot, and you're walking back to your car from the supermarket, and you see somebody open their door into your car? Once in a while that happens, right? What's your response? What's that? Hey, that's my car, right? Immediately, right? Okay, because that's how we're also taught by our culture. I was taught that by my parents. You go, hey, I've seen how they would respond. Okay, Buddhist cultures are different. Okay, ask Geshe Gelug how people respond in his culture. Now, some of them might respond that way, but some of them not. At the monastery, it's quite like people, and Tibetans are like the antithesis of us. We're overly expressive. Tibetans, you know, and when something goes wrong in a community and stuff, they often let it naturally work its way out. We confront it. So it's challenging for us. It's challenging for us. So it's great that you're here. You're giving it a shot. So what if you see the car door open there? Okay. You're walking over to the car. You might still have a little bing. Ah, my car. Hey. Okay. So sometimes now I amuse myself with that inner voice. The inner voice of my affliction. Talk to your affliction. It's okay. Talk to your delusion. You know, I'll be like, yeah, okay. Here she comes, little riot squad. You know, what are you going to do now? Right? Okay, helmet up. Get your helmet and your shield on. No, my choice is I can be a bodhisattva warrior. Different kind of helmet and shield. Bodhisattva warriors, okay, bring all their loving kindness, you know, inspired by the other person's experience. Wow, look, they've got their arms full. Did I ever bump into somebody else's car? Did you do it on purpose? No, the car door flung open. Oops. I was on a hill. Oops, I didn't catch the door. And it's happened to me many times. I didn't intend to hit somebody's car. The other thing is I'm walking over to my car. Remember, these are all your little tools. This is my toolbox, Bodhisattva Warrior. Got my little satchel of tools, right? The other thing is, this is samsara, right? The nature of your car in samsara is it's going to get dinged. That's its nature. That's its true nature. You know that with your car. Like 15 years later, your car's going to be in perfect shape. Are you kidding me? What kind of fantasy is that? Right? It causes you so much suffering. Somebody close to me in my life bought a sports car a few years ago. Had to have this car. Went to unbelievable lengths. Got the car. Then had to have a sound system for the car. Had to have the right wheels for the car. It's been a whole venture with this car. Car has to be housed in the winter, so God forbid it gets one smote of salt on it from the snow. So that necessitated buying another car for the winter. And then this car we drove in, the wheel got messed up, and that cost a fortune getting it fixed. Because, it's endless. This is what we do. It's a continual. So, again, I'm walking over to the car, Bodhisattva warrior. They would take a deep breath first. They might notice their little reactive self, okay? I'm just going to breathe that little reactive self out of my consciousness right now. I'm going to exhale and off it goes. And I've opened my door into cars. This is my mind. Something coming back to me. I'm purifying right now if they dent in my car. I'd like to have a healthy interaction with that person so I can have healthier, create healthier causes and results for me in the future. I've done this to people. Their arms are full. Oh, look, it's an old woman. Come over. Hi, how you doing? Oh, I'm sorry. It's okay, you know. Maybe there's some major dent and they want to do something. Rarely. But it's really, can I keep my mind spacious and open by understanding a little bit more how the world goes around like that? A little bit more consciousness of others. Bring in bodhicitta as well from the space like that. I really like this about... We'll just go a little bit over. I don't want to keep you too much longer. But has anybody read this book, My Stroke of Insight? Jill Bolt Taylor. Okay, I highly recommend. Jill Bolt Taylor. This is Jill Day. We have a couple Jills here. Okay. It's called My Stroke of Insight. My Stroke of Insight. She's done, I think she did a TED Talk as well. You could watch. She's a neuroanatomist, neuroscientist. She studies the anatomy of the brain. So at the age of 37, she had a major stroke. And while it was happening, because she's a neuroanatomist, she knew what was happening, that part of her brain's melting down. And parts of it are with humor, of her trying to contact her office to get medical help, because in a stroke, the first few hours are critical, and she knew this. And it's about her seven-year full recovery. Very interesting book. It's very heartwarming, parts of it. And it also helps you deal with stroke victims if you're ever around people with strokes. She has a whole part in the back about how to talk to stroke victims. And, you know, basically they're not incapacitated totally. It's just their brain is injured and it's healing. You know, so they may need you to make eye contact when you speak to them. You may need to speak slowly, clearly. And you're going to have patience to wait for them to get their brain together to respond to you. But it can educate them and help them in the recovery. She said the people that came into the room, moving really quickly, not making eye contact, just checking off, she said they drained her energy. And then she had an intern come in. A guy sat down close to her, you know, put his chart down, made eye contact with her, held her hand, asked her if that was okay, and spoke slowly, softly. You know, she said it was so uplifting for her to have this interaction. She said, I'm sure he'll be a great doctor. And so what she says, knowing the brain, and now I'm talking about the brain, something physical, the mind's not physical, separate from the brain. She said that the actual neurological activity, let's say of anger coming in, okay, so the mind creates the brain's function, the brain to function, is what Buddhism says. So now you've got a neurological activity of anger moving through. Something got activated in the mind, made me angry. Now it's moving through. I'm thinking angry thoughts. The neurological activity is functioning. She said, okay, for that to move through your system, roughly, how long does that take, would you say?
Microsecond.
Anybody else? Okay, 90 seconds. 90 seconds is that experience for the beginning of the angry thought till it washes out of your system. You get a minute and a half. Okay, that's it. So please ask me, why do we carry it on? Right? It's unbelievable, out of habit. Goes on and on, but it's 90 seconds. Okay? So out of habit, and this is analytical meditation. Somebody irritates you. You spin out around it. First you have your 90 second wash. In the body, out. But now it's like they did that. Look at him. He's so stupid. He's so irritating. Oh, now he's going to go and tell her. Now he's going to go over in there. Then you go home at night. Then you tell your partner. Then he said this. Then he said that. Now he's looking like that. And the next time he's going to do that. That's analytical meditation. You're coming from every angle, right, to convince yourself the person's a jerk. Okay, so it's not directed on anything positive. But we know how to do analytical meditation really well. Okay? So what I do now is I'll notice an afflictive emotion coming through my mind. It could be fear. It could be attachment, pride, jealousy, you name it. What a depression. Well, whatever your things are, we all have these delusions, right? I now allow myself the 90 seconds. I'll just kind of acknowledge, okay, detach from the afflictive emotion, meaning, God, there's anger in my mind right now. You know, and sometimes it's a little puffy. Oh, I'm a little irritated. I just allow myself to notice it in my mind. If I'm alone, you can speak out loud if you want, right? But I'll just notice, I'll be like, you're at a meeting, I'm really getting irritated right now. I'll just say in my mind, I'm really getting irritated. Mm-hmm. Right? And then have your little 90 seconds, you know, do, 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 and then it's gone. That's it. Do, do, do. Okay, finished. Right? So, but think about it. So whatever the thing is, like you see somebody really attractive, you know, just watch that little wash through the system again. Okay? But see if you can then, done, enough. Let it go. What is the essence of the thought anyway? Think about it. What is the essence of the thought? Where does the thought come from? What's that?
It's a story.
It's a story. Yep. Thoughts create the story, right? So under my story, I've got thoughts. What's under the thoughts? Previous moment of mind, yeah. Moments of consciousness, moments of mind. Another thought like that. So if I want to let the angry thought go on, I'm creating a deep rut of angry thoughts. I'm creating a pattern and a habit in my mind that's perpetuating anger in my mind or attachment. Or chronic depression is a perfect example of that. Anxiety. People who worry. Well, they're really good at worrying, and they worry a lot because they practice worrying. They exercise worrying. They rehearse it all the time. And then they'll even say, I'm a worrier. Or I'm a depressed person. No, actually, you just have a lot of depression in your mind. See the difference? You just have depression in your mind. That's not innate with your mind. Remind yourself the nature of your mind. It's not depression or fear or anger or attachment. Mm-mm. It's clear and it's knowing. That's your mind. So these are ways you're trying to get at reality. You're trying to get, and you have to keep using different tools, different techniques, depending on the situation. But I love just, okay, 90 seconds. Wow, I'm really angry right now. And done. Okay. Bring up another thought. If you need to interrupt the thought and replace it with something more positive. Again, it's going to take practice. It's going to take practice. You know, or analyze. What are you really afraid of? People that suffer from anxiety and fear. You know, analyze it. You know, look at anger. What's underneath anger? We were just talking about this in here or some. What's underneath anger? Anybody? We talked about fear, we talked about control, sometimes sadness. You know, sometimes I think anger is sad's bodyguard, isn't it? Isn't it? Unbelievable how anger gets, you know? So all these things, this is you knowing your mind. Knowing your mind, and then learning the techniques gently, practically, reasonably, to do what you need to do in your life. And I give an example on a practical level, because I teach a lot on a practical level. So there's some people I know in my life that I love dearly, and I will continue to spend time with them. But when two of them get together alone, they end up talking about certain topics I find obsessively that are exclusive. Other people around them don't know the players, don't know the people, and they're very dominant, these two people, so they mow over everybody else in the space. Okay. And it's not helpful. And other people have mentioned they feel uncomfortable when they're around these two people, when they get motoring, talking about this one thing they do together. And I've noticed this, right? So I started noticing how uncomfortable I felt, and I was like, what's going on with this? It's just about me. And then I went, God, it's really kind of not great the way they just get into this thing. So then I started protecting myself, realizing if they ask me to go out with them and do something, just the three of us, I've actually had to either decline, you know, and because also I don't feel that safe, and they get into kind of trashing women, and it's just not a great space for me. It's just not something I choose to be around. Or I've just managed to come in for an hour of the space. Had a happy time, this is great, and now actually see you guys later, I got to go. So it's a way I've protected where I'd end up in the space kind of feeling fragmented and like this isn't beneficial, this isn't helpful. So it's not like I'm cutting them out of my life, and I'm not judging them, I'm not turning up with an agenda of you guys are such jerks, that I'm just kind of like, this isn't about changing them, this is me working with my mind. And that's as good as I can do with them, is spend that hour. And then what I did at one point, because I'm very close with them, I was able to talk to one of them once when they kept saying, how come you don't want to go with us? And because I felt close enough to this person, I explained to them how I felt. I said, again with compassionate wisdom, sometimes when I'm with you and you guys get onto this subject, I just feel completely unheard and unseen, and it's like, better that you're just on your own together, because I'm totally excluded and I don't really feel like it's great that we're together, and I feel really kind of ignored, and I don't think it's a great space to be. And then he said immediately to me, other people said that to us. So he's aware, and he goes, we're aware of it, we're working on it. And I said, cool, great. And I said, it's nothing personal, and So it's just acknowledging it. So they're actually, I've noticed recently, they are changing, because it made awareness with kind of compassion, not kind of you're stupid and all you do is talk about that and it's stupid. No, it's not stupid. It's something interesting to them. And so you can skillfully kind of find a way, an appropriate time to have that conversation. Okay, let me just ask where we are, because it's 3:30. I just want to know, how are people doing? Do you need a break for bathroom? We could do a quick meditation at the end. Do you want to just go a little bit more, or are we over and out? How are people doing? People doing okay? A little bit more. Okay, let's do a little bit more. Thank you. I know if you need to go, I understand. One thing I'd like to say before we break, and thank you for doing your prison work, I do want to dedicate today. Please dedicate when you can today. It is the 49th day of this man I was helping, who was on death row in Georgia. Geshe Gelick also was involved. And his name is Daniel Lucas. So if you could please keep him in your prayers. Today's his 49th day after death, when he'll transition, at least, definitely transition at this point to the next rebirth, and I hope it's a good one for him. That would be helpful. And if you want to read more about him, I mentioned it last night, but it's on my website on the homepage. You can read a little account of the interaction I was having with him. Really extraordinary man who found Dharma in prison after 19 years in prison, and unfortunately was executed the end of April in Georgia at the age of 37. So it's very young. Yeah, very young. So but I think you can transform your mind like that. Anybody can do. It's totally true. So again, I just wanted to go back to, and I'll repeat some of this tomorrow, but I love the thing from Rinpoche of, then you see Amy appears inherently, okay, decorated by your ignorance. You know, because of my ignorance, I'm not able to see myself clearly. It makes it real. It makes it real, that which is not there. Okay? And then you trust that, which is not true. That which is false. Okay? I'm seeing I might do another meditation because I want to explain tomorrow the four-part analysis before we... let me see what else I might want to do here. Okay, let's try this meditation. And tomorrow we're going to do more of four-part analysis, the more traditional meditation on emptiness. So just sit comfortably. And where is Susie? Perfect cup of tea. Thank you. She's like, I hope it's okay. I'm like, it's just tea. It's okay. Okay. And let me just read you a little preface into this, okay? We're going to look about how strong negative emotions get activated, okay? But pay attention in general, okay? Because of the self-cherishing thought, you know, I'm glommed onto myself. This isn't self-grasping, because I'm so focused on myself, okay? You didn't achieve enlightenment and liberation since beginningless time. This is from Lama Zopa Rinpoche. Since beginningless rebirth, if you don't eliminate this demon, the self-cherishing thought, from the heart, you'll never be able to achieve enlightenment and be able to liberate all living beings. This self-cherishing thought has been harming all living beings, directly and indirectly. So if you don't do something about it, it's terrifying. Therefore, you can't wait even a second. You can't stand it not to eliminate it immediately. And the I that it cherishes, the truly existent I, does not exist at all. It's not there. It's unbelievably foolish. It's just a little dose of Lama Zopa Rinpoche. Okay? So let's just try a little bit right here. Just relax, close your eyes. Allow your awareness to settle on your breath. And now contemplate how strong negative emotions, like the ones I just mentioned, such as anger, arise in dependence upon the recognition of yourself. For example, would the anger that arises when somebody directly criticizes you arise if you thought he or she was speaking to someone else? Recall any personal experiences you have like this. And so, for instance, this could also arise in the form of flattery. You think somebody's saying something pleasing and flattering to you. Notice how the mind gets activated, the pride, the fluttery attachment, and then you hear it's actually about somebody else. Has that ever happened to you? Just notice how the eye arises in that space, or in the case of somebody criticizing or attacking you, you thought it was about you, Notice how that feels, what arises. And then when you found out it was about somebody else. What happened the last time you couldn't find your phone? Can you call up that experience in your mind? The last time you couldn't find your phone. Was it no big deal? Didn't you just said, I'll just deal with it later? Or was it something else? Can you get that strong sense of yourself that arose if it did? You can play with other things. You're walking back to your car in a parking lot. You see somebody open their door into your car. Was there a response, a reaction in your mind? Then you realize it wasn't your car. Did anything change? Or use another example from your life. Something that calls up this strong sense of yourself and how these strong emotions arise in dependence upon the recognition of yourself. Okay, there's an alternative. If you notice sometimes a reaction, a negative reaction. There's an alternative, okay? People who do not take themselves so seriously. Doesn't mean you don't participate in the world effectively and actively. But people who do not see themselves so strongly based on this false identity, who I think I am. Okay? They understand that their identity is a conceptual fabrication. Okay, they see their existence as something normally posited only through the force of social conventions. Okay, so they don't cling to any particular image of themselves. They remain in a natural, unfabricated state. Okay, it takes practice though. It takes practice. But go back through your situations you might have brought to mind. How would you respond to losing your phone from a natural, unfabricated state? In a sense, do a little role play here. You're going to exercise this. Rehearse it. From a natural, unfabricated state. Or use it, somebody opening the door into your car. Use it in the case of the last negative interaction, the last time you got irritated with someone. What's a new response from a natural, unfabricated state? So please relax. Interesting? I mean, it's not easy to do. It's not so easy. But is it helpful? A little bit? And again, it takes exercise. Some of you may be doing this daily. You've done a lot of emptiness meditation. Right now, I'm just trying to get you the sense of how the I comes up inherently, concretely, center of everything. You know? And how from that recognition, that's where those negative emotions come from. That's how they get activated. Like that. So if you're trying to find this natural, unfabricated state, it's not that you don't have a mind and you're like, blah. Okay. It's actually, you come from a very dynamic place. But it's merged together with your compassionate wisdom. But that's your freedom. So if you're satisfied with running over to the person that dented your car and yelling at them, if you think that's a great response, because we practice that a lot of times, because my social convention, meaning my parents or my friends or other people showed me how to behave in that case that way. Okay, it doesn't mean it's right, but I've well rehearsed that because of patterns around me, influences around me. Okay, so what if you're trying to bring in loving kindness, wisdom, and compassion? That merges you together with the natural and fabricated space of who you really are. That's your freedom. So again, you've got the enlightenment path that's going to bring you there, or I've got the path of utter delusion. Okay. Most of us are somewhere in the middle, merged together, but then we fall off, we fall down again, we make a mistake, and then you lay a big trip on yourself. You don't have to lay a trip on yourself. You're trying. For me, I make mistakes all the time. I pick myself back up, try to learn the message. Okay, that didn't really work very well that way. So let me rehearse it again. Take it out there again. Okay, but it does offer you the possibility to feel more spacious, freer. Again, let it go, let it be. Right? But in that space, I'm motivated by loving kindness, compassion, and wisdom. And that feels good. And that's actually innate with who you are, those qualities. It's actually closer to who you really are, more than anger and attachment and pride and jealousy and fear and paranoia and things like that. So this is a rehearsal, and we have to make the effort in the sense of reminding ourselves as we lift every veil of obscuration. You know, it's like an onion. You know, the Buddha nature is in there, and then you just keep peeling a layer, each layer, and then it comes shining through. Some of us have heavier blankets of obscuration. And then the main thing is know your delusion. Know your delusion. Okay? So you want to know what's your biggest delusion first. Go after that. For some of you, it's attachment. Some of you are full of anxiety. You're immediately like, that's my thing. Or depression. Or anger. Like, so go after the big one first. Start to tackle that one. So here's something I want. Does it make sense? Is it helpful? Helpful. Okay. So this is your homework. Yes, please. Yeah, please.
I've got a couple of questions. The first is, how does one distinguish between clear knowing and karmic perception or conditioned notion? Because when I'm meditating, sometimes I get this sense of insight coming to me, and I get this comfort receiving that insight or that knowledge. But on a day-to-day functioning, how do I distinguish when it's clear knowing versus karmic or conditioned perception? My second question is...
Wait, let's do the first one first.
Okay.
So you're saying conditioned thing or karmic, which do you mean?
So you were sharing with us how our preconceived, or rather the karmic seeds in us, then add on a certain gauze or layering over the raw data, right?
They cause us to experience things in a certain way,
yes. So I was referring to that.
Okay. Because conditioned things would be different, meaning if somebody opens their door into my car, and I've seen my mother react negatively in that case in her car, that's a conventional influence from my, like, you know, that's not my karma necessarily. I mean, it's part of my karma, but the karma, my karmic seeds could respond in a variety of ways based on what's in there. I was just talking, were you talking about conventional influence versus my karmic propensities? Part of it would be in developing our wisdom, we start to have faith in our insights and to see. And we get insights all the time. I think Westerners, particularly Americans, when we talk about insight and realization, we want something massive and huge. You know, I want to see God, and he had purple lights coming out of him, and then I knew I was having an experience. But it's not like that. We have lots of small insights all the time. And I think it's great to wake up to that as well, but in a balanced way. Not that I'm great, but I think through our wisdom you start to realize, I'm able to observe my mind a little bit more. or I'm actually realizing I need to change something in my practice because this is getting kind of stale, and you know, and seeing something a little bit more truly, a little bit more really, I think that just comes from developing our wisdom to acknowledge. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does.
And the second question?
Well, the second question is, what would you say that children, probably, are they, would you say that they are in a better place compared to adults to receive or to cultivate that wisdom towards nirvana?
I think if you can teach kids from a young age, then they have many more years of the potential of positive imprints. If you come to the Dharma when you're 25, it starts to open you up at 25, but you've had maybe 25 years of seeing it being influenced in another way. If you come to the Dharma at 40, the same. So at kids, it's just earlier. It's like the young Rinpoches, when they're recognized, a young lama at the age of 2 or 3, and then they're often brought to the monastery early, it's for them to begin that approach to refresh their minds, kind of relearn the knowledge. So the earlier you get to it, the better it could be. It doesn't mean they're in a better place, kids, at that point. Some kids are fully delusional. Mm-hmm. You meet kids. Different kids who, you see kids who are really into killing insects from a young age. And then you see some that are like, no, don't touch the ant. So that's their own karmic propensity. It doesn't mean kids are any more enlightened. It's just that at a younger age, you can place more imprints in there than we might have had at a younger age, you know, where I didn't really have Dharma from a young age like that.
So that would be, because my understanding is that wisdom requires a certain, I suppose, cognitive development or maturity to understand Dharma. It adds on to the ability to then practice and at the same time, you know, accumulate, I suppose, little bits of wisdom, if I may, you know,
mm-hmm.
towards understanding non-self, dependent origination. So I'm just very intrigued by how we could help children. And my question really also is about, can a child attain nirvana?
For the child, I don't know. It would depend individually on their karmic imprints that they have, because some of the young Rinpoches have, or highly realized beings might have, some more insight at a young age. But this is the way we educate kids in the Dharma, and through our children's programs a lot, and through universal education. And there's a school in Sarnath, India, where Valentino, an Italian man, has started this Alice school. So for instance, if a kid is hitting another kid with a stick, you can start right there to say to the kid, well, you're angry at the kid who's doing it, but you're not angry at the stick. But it's a stick that's actually hitting you. So there are ways you start to break down the kid's thing to realize this interrelated reality that we're operating. And you might say, well, but the stick doesn't think. But it's a way to start. We realize how there's many factors involved in delusion getting activated. And then it goes on from there. We have many things we've gone through with the kids of the 16 guidelines, teaching kids about patience and generosity and loving kindness. And so many times we're introducing to kids, if a child hits a child, to say, is that really an experience of the highest level of your wisdom and compassion? Like, and kids understand that. Some kids really, they'll think about that, or they'll go, was that really, like, and I've worked with a lot of kids. For instance, visualize a flower at your heart. Kids can do that. And then you go, what kind of flower? And they're all like, sunflower, rose. They all have their flowers, right? How open is your flower right now to your friends, to the people in the room? So they can notice when they're around somebody they don't like, how closed up the flower is, that's like their mind, closed, little, you know. But wouldn't it be nice to get more sunshine and rain onto the flower? It opens up the flower. So maybe if you smile, that's a little bit of sunshine on that person, opens up their flower. Like expressing love, explaining to them what that's about, wanting somebody else to be happy, and, you know, things like that. But then they have normal delusion operating where they don't want to share a toy. And then you go through the standard things of, you know, but you just wanted to play with his truck and he let you play with it. That was fun, wasn't it? So you don't want to give her a little experience of what it's like to play with your, you know, so slowly we bring them into things like that. The other thing we did at one of the family camps, you probably do it here, some of the deities you see, do I see anybody, let's see. Anyway, we had themes of our camp. This is Vajrapani. So 1 year it was Tara, 1 year it was Chenrezig, or, you know. Okay, you could say, here's the Medicine Buddha, the blue one, right here, this big picture, okay? So, but even a better one was we used Vajrapani 1 year, because that was the name of the center, right? Well, Vajrapani is a big wrathful guy, full fire and, like, you know. So for kids, it's scary, but they love their superheroes. Give me a break. They're really frightening. So Vajrapani is like a superhero. In fact, he's the ultimate superhero because he represents infinite power, meaning divine power, skillful means, right? So they totally got off on that. And they're all walking around our stupa like Vajrapani, you know? So it's a little bit, you can put it into those terms, and they resonate. They get that. So I think you can, whether they're going to understand the Madhyamaka Prasangika, no, not at that age. But when you start them at that age, talking about how they're seeing that a fight with a friend, they come home, and if the parents right then can say, well, so he hit you. Did you ever hit anybody? And they're like, you know, did you feel better when you hit them? Sometimes I felt a little better, but not, you know. But they understand that they hit, and that creates a ramification that you're going to get hit back. So that could hit. And when you hit, were you really clear in thinking when you hit? Or were you operating out of, you know, selfishness and frustration? And, you know, and then you can get them to talk about those experiences. And then they realize, yeah, that's really not the most spacious place of mind. And you can refer to them when they get grumpy, you know, what kind of mind is like that. And one time we were going to go out, and then my niece who was grumpy, she wasn't, but her brother was. And then suddenly we reminded him the other day when she was grumpy how upset he got, because then he was like, it's going to ruin our day. And I'm like, so now you're going to ruin our day? And then all of a sudden he was like, oh. So kids understand at that level. They understand a lot, frankly. And those are just ways I work with kids sometimes.
Thank you.
Like that. Yes. I hope that's helpful. Yeah.
I guess if you want to look at it further, it's not in print anymore because they ran out of copies, but Lama Zopa, a book was recently published called Joyful Parents, Successful Children. And a lot of the answers to your questions are in that. And if you, I think it's Lama Yeshe Wisdom Archives, and it's free. You can download it. And it's
great.
You know, and you can go back to it. That's what's nice, you know.
Yeah, we have more and more parents and children materials.
Yeah, he really addresses a lot of your questions from both the point side of the child and from the side of the parent.
Great. Other questions, comments? Is everybody clear? Is everybody doing okay? Yes. You're doing all right? Is it helpful? So far, we're kind of going slowly through. But tomorrow we talk about the four-part analysis, traditional way of meditating on emptiness, looking at emptiness and things like that.
Quick comment. When you were talking about the door of the car hitting your car, one of the biggest slaps upside the head was having a child, and they're watching you. And worse yet, you're on a field trip taking them somewhere, and they're all watching you. And I just keep that mindset in, even though they're grown, and they're not watching me right now. But it really helps me. Well, how do I want somebody to see me and mimic me?
You're an example. A lot of people say, how do I change my husband? How do I be an example? And kids mirror, totally mirror you. Totally mirror. So, but even with friends and family, want to be an example. I mean, I joke with my dad if I get irritated. I mean, I don't know if any of you are in the construction trades. I don't know what goes on in the construction trades, but in California, Vermont, Philadelphia, England, you call somebody to do your roof, to do tiling, to fix something, da-da-da-da, your garden, your things. They never call back. Initially, they might call back because it's a new job. And then they're doing work, and they never plan to finish it, and you try to call back, and then they mess something up, and they're going to come back, and It's just been unbelievable with this roofer we're dealing with and a gardener. Just the lawn mowing guy. I'm like, what is the deal? What kind of karma have I created that I didn't get back to people? Not this life. I'm not like that in this life. I always get back to people, generally, 99% of the time. But my dad and I must have created something in the past, right? So I laugh, and he'll go, oh, a Buddhist nun gets irritated? And I'm like, you bet. You know, like, but it's true, like, just mirrored. You have to be careful that the people see, your kids see, and, you know, things like that. And so just be an example. You're really trying. But again, you make mistakes. Like that. So here's your homework, okay? I want you to think about your motivation now until the next class. Whether you come tomorrow morning, whether you come in the afternoon. What are you going to do after this class? What are you going to do? Going to leave here, drive, okay. None of it happens without the thought of I. It becomes the basis of all of our actions. It's not like somebody else is going to dinner tonight. It's not like somebody else is going home or driving your car. Somebody else has clothes to wash. Okay, it's I. I'm going to do this. Okay, and because it's me, the body follows, as does other mental and verbal activity. That's the basis for the action. This thought, I. It's, I'm the one who's going to act. The motivation is on the basis of this thought, I. I'm trying to get you to have a really strong sense of the inherently existent I that we're going to meditate on tomorrow. How the I arises. The hardest part of the four-part analysis is to find that object. Find that object, okay? This is I that motivates oneself. All the actions are involved with creating one's experience in the future, and they're all based upon the thought, I. So the way in which you see yourself is significant. It's important. It's crucial for your future experience. So I want you to be mindful when you think of yourself. Okay? You want to try to look at yourself objectively and neutrally. Okay? And also, just so notice, it's a more observation of the mind and how the eye gets motored. Can you keep a tally of the number of times you think of I? Right? It's interesting, isn't it? Be especially mindful when you feel a strong emotion. When you feel a strong emotion. You're just going to start to notice this I that arises. Okay? Now granted, again, there's a conventional I that's moving through stuff. And then there's this other very strong inherent concept of the I that comes up. That's the one I'm more interested in now. If you see that get activated, you know. How is it different than the conventional I? Well, you know, I'm in my car and suddenly I'm watching that there is an I labeled on my body and mind that's turning the key in the ignition and we're just moving through space. But if I suddenly have this placement of that I as a very concrete entity that's not labeled on the body and mind, that, and somebody makes a wrong turn and gets in front of my car, he's in my lane. You know, what's that I about? How does that work? How does that feel? Does that make sense? Just try that a little bit. You can continue to see things as products. Again, because we've gone through how everything comes in, arises and comes into existence based on different things, that it comes from other parts and other situations. Like that. Okay. So tomorrow we start at 10 again? 10:30. What is this, asleep in here? Huh? Okay. 10:30 until
12. It's in the morning, Sunday Dharma, and then 1:30 and 3:30.
Is there a meditation before the 10:30?
9 to 10.
9 to 10. Who leads that?
Venerable Lama usually leads that. It's unguided.
Great. Okay, very nice. So that's 9 to 10, and then 10:30 I'll be back with a little morning, 10:30 to 12? Okay. So 10:30 to 12, we're going to have a nice thing about the fundamental ambiguity of being human. Okay? What do you do with your groundlessness? That I think relates very much to emptiness, but it's different, a little bit different. And then we're going to continue tomorrow afternoon on the four-part analysis and meditation on emptiness. like that. So I hope it hasn't been too much of a review of things that, but it's always good to hear, again, a little bit from different ways. I also want to continue to analyze the pen, a little bit of how, if we're trying to find the pen, we have to be very specific. And let me just give you one last thing to think about, and we'll go through this again tomorrow because I know some people left. If you're analyzing the pen, here's what goes on for us. Again, pen is mundane, but I'm trying to get you to lessen mine. So I need to analyze, how does this come into existence? Okay, and if I say to you, we need to find the pen that I'm grasping onto, and I say, inherently, there's no pen there, and you go, what, are you kidding me? But, so they say, but there's a pen in your hands. Okay, right? Well, I'm going to be very specific with emptiness. I am holding down here. See where I'm holding? If I take that piece off, because you say that's what's in your hands, the pen, and hold that up for you, you're not going to call that pen. It's a piece of plastic. I can hold this up and say, where's the pen? And you point and you go, here. I'm going to be very specific and take that part out and go, that's the side of the pen. Or this is the side of the pen. It's not the pen. Or it's a little piece of plastic I could hold up for you. Okay. So if you want to look for the pen in its parts, if you want to look for the pen in its parts, I did this with my car several times. I disassembled my car years ago in my driveway. Disassembled. I wanted to really, you know. But here's the pen. I'm going to look for the pen. There's got to be some concrete existing. It looks so solid, the pen. I'm holding this thing. Right? So let me find the pen. This very solid existing pen. Okay. It's not the plastic tube. If I held that up, you're going to say that's a plastic tube. This is not pen, right? This is cap of the pen. Okay. If I took this piece out, that's not pen. If I took the ink cartridge out inside and held it up, that's not pen, that's ink cartridge. That's labeled ink cartridge. Okay. So literally, disassemble. See, put all these out in front of you. Plastic tube, the cap, the ink cartridge, the metal top, the little plastic bottom. Take the ink out. You put all those in front of you. Is everybody with me? None of those is pen individually, right? You're not finding any pen there, correct? So people say, okay, got it. But when you put them together, the collection is the pen, right? 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 Wrong. Okay? Why? You just looked in all the parts and didn't find pen. So listen carefully. You looked in all the parts and didn't find pen. There's no pen in any of the parts. There's no pen. So you're going to put those parts together and say that there's a pen there? You already looked in all the parts. No pen. How can you put all the parts together and find a pen? What you find is a valid basis designation. Plastic cylindrical tube filled with ink that writes. My mind sees the data and labels pen on that. And then the pen comes into existence. So don't get fooled by the collection. It's also not the collection. A lot of people get hooked there. Analyze again. Go home tonight. I want you to think about it. Disassemble your car in the driveway. This worked for me. The tires, the windshield, the chassis, the engine, the motor, the carburetor, the brakes, the seats. I had all the pieces in my mind. There's no car there in the pieces. I put it together, but I already looked thoroughly through all the pieces. There's no car in the pieces. There's no car in the pieces. Get used to that. There's no pen in the parts of the pen. You can't put them together and then a pen's there because you already looked. There's no pen. Okay, it's a little bit more subtle. But what does come there is a valid basis of designation. There's a gap covered over by my ignorance where my mind labels pen and then the pen arises and comes in to being. There's no inherently existent pen there at all. No concretely existing, unchanging, independent pen that is there. Because again, it would be there for all beings. A dog would say, pen, but it doesn't. Okay? We communicating? Mm-hmm. Anyway, please think about that. That's critical. It's a critical piece. What I'd like to do right now is I'd like to dedicate whatever positive energy we've created and thinking about emptiness, meditating on emptiness, doing any of these exercises, super helpful. to create merit. So may we invest it in our being able to understand emptiness more and more clearly, that will help propel us along a path to full enlightenment, so we can perfectly serve all other beings. And I'd like to just turn quickly in the Gold Prayer Book. To page 246, Master Shantideva. Let's just send this out to the universe. May all beings everywhere, plagued by sufferings of body and mind, obtain an ocean of happiness and joy by virtue of my merits. May no living creature suffer, commit evil, or ever fall ill. May no one be afraid or belittled with a mind weighed down by depression. May the blind see forms and the deaf hear sounds. May those whose bodies are worn with toil be restored on finding repose. May the naked find clothing, the hungry find food. May the thirsty find water and delicious drinks. May the poor find wealth, those weak with sorrow find joy. May the forlorn find hope, constant happiness, and prosperity. May timely rains and bountiful harvests. May all medicines be effective and wholesome prayers bear fruit. May all who are sick and ill quickly be freed from their ailments. Whatever diseases there are in the world, may they never occur again. May the frightened cease to be afraid. Those bound be freed. May the powerless find power. May people think of benefiting each other. For as long as space remains, for as long as sentient beings remain, until then may I too remain to dispel the miseries of the world. Page 244, for the long lives of all of our holy teachers. Oh, Ganri Ranwe Gowe Jing Kam De Pendang De Wa Malu Jung We Ne Chen Re Zig Wang Ten Jing Gya Tso Yi Sharpe Si Te Bar Du Teng Yur Jin. You who uphold the subduer's moral way, who serve as the bountiful bearer of all, sustaining, preserving, and spreading Manjunath's victorious doctrine, masterfully accomplished magnificent prayers honoring the three jewels, Savior of myself and others, your disciples, please, please live long. May we also dedicate to all the beings on the planet needing additional healing. May they receive it completely, and may all the conflicts in the world be pacified. And also we could dedicate, I think Muhammad Ali passed away, could dedicate to him. Have a great rebirth to benefit all, to be the greatest, so he can be a Buddha, okay? And all the other beings who have recently passed away, and to Daniel Lucas, may he immediately transition to a wonderful rebirth to benefit all. Thank you very much. Hope to see you tomorrow.
Do you mind if I read the sponsors?
No, please, please. Okay. Feel free.
Susie Baum, in gratitude for the kindness of all our Dharma teachers, Neil Oldham, to the Sangha and their spread of the Dharma, with special thanks to Venerable Amy for her work on Buddhism in a nutshell. Sandy Carlson, any positive potential created by this sponsorship is dedicated to the long, healthy, happy lives of His Holiness, the Dalai Lama, Ken Rinpoche, Jitsun Losam Delek, Lama Zopa Rinpoche, Geshe Gelek, Geshe Sangpo, Venerable Amy, and all our precious Sangha. May Kodama Center's community continue to be of benefit to each other and countless sentient beings for eons and eons. Donna Cease, by hearing these precious teachings, may we create the cause to see emptiness directly and liberate ourselves from samsara. Having freed ourselves, may we become Buddhas and return to lead all sentient beings to the bliss of liberation. Diane Mayer, dedicated to Joan Loeb Miller, mentor and guide. John Castillo, may our precious teacher stay with us all the way to enlightenment.
John was very helpful with the prisoner Daniel, and what he did is, because Daniel got unlimited phone calls domestically, but he was trying to reach some people internationally. So John showed up at the office at different times so Daniel could phone him, and then he patched him through via Skype calls to France and to some other people. It was very, very helpful. And then, so thank you so much. It was nice to meet you, and very precious. We were all in touch, you know, over this whole thing. And then what happened for me, I think, did I mention this the other night? So what happened in his last day is the execution was supposed to be scheduled between 7 p.m. and midnight, he told me. So we had to say goodbye the day before, because he told me that when they move him, it's so surreal, to the room next to the execution chamber, he's not allowed any more phone calls. So, you know, it was very hard to say goodbye. We got quite attached in a couple weeks, and I was on the phone with him maybe an hour to three a day, right, leading meditations and things. So then I say goodbye, and then it's the next day, and I'm trying to do practice for him. But then I made my father dinner, and then it was 7 o'clock, right? So I was thinking about him and thinking, like, what, you know, for me the whole thing is just so macabre. It's so weird, the death area is a death penalty. So then I was just thinking, like, and then the phone rang, like 3 minutes after 7, and it was him, Daniel. And I, did I tell you about this? No. I was telling you in the car, right? So then I thought maybe there was a reprieve. I said, what's happened? What? And he said, I'm now in the room next to the execution chamber. Like, so they let him make a phone call, but there he was, like, and one time he said to me, I couldn't believe where I'm leading a death meditation for him, and we get to the time of death is uncertain, right? And so all of a sudden he says to me, blurts out in the middle of this meditation, this is the hardest one to realize of the 9 points. The time of death is uncertain, because we always think we're going to die when we're old. And we even say, when I'm old, but you don't know, right? So all of a sudden he blurts out to me, he said, Venerable Amy, I don't know if I'm going to even make it to the execution or die first. Like, he really kept it in my face, I got to say. He was really... So then we ended up on the phone for 2 hours, 7 to 9, right, while the lawyers are trying to last appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court. And every once in a while, every half hour, the lawyer would come back on and say, oh, no news yet. And he was really nervous, you know, but really strong-minded, but very nervous, and obviously. So I was leading all these meditations and reading all these prayers to him, and you know, going really well. And then all of a sudden, 9 o'clock, the lawyer comes on and says, it's been denied, the appeal. And then he said to me, I think they're going to be moving quickly now. And an hour later, he was gone. You know, just, for me, it was bizarre. I've never been that close to a death penalty situation. I'm just glad I was there to get the phone call and could be there. And very nice guy, yeah? So, I mean, he's really, I think he hopefully, you know, really transcended some things. But for me, it was so surreal. The whole thing was so weird. So we can remember him today like that, hoping he's getting a better situation than spending another 30, 40 years in prison. Let's hope.